poetry than you've been asked for yet, of course. On the other hand, by now you should, from our past sessions, have sufficient sense of Yeats and of what to look for and what to look out for, what to beware of, that is to say, in reading him. And you'll also find that these pages, which represent on the whole Yeats's writing of the 1920s and the early 1930s at the end, we have already taken samplings of at various times through the course. We have talked, for instance, briefly about sailing to Byzantium and Byzantium. We've talked about Parnell's funeral. We've talked about Leda and the Swan. We've even, in passing, said something about Among School Children. So it is it should not be all strange to you by any means. I'll just say by way of introduction to this body of reading that there are plenty of people, I mean respectable people, whose opinions I respect, who believe, in general, that Yeats got better and better right up to the end. And that the older he got, the better he got. I can see this way of looking at this later work of his. He certainly gets more and more adventurous, more and more rash, takes bigger and bigger risks. Sometimes these risks are magnificently successful. Again, in certain earlier sessions we've seen this, I'm thinking of one level of risks that are merely technical risks, like those extraordinary rhymes which he dares and pulls off from time to time, for instance. He also risks many other things. His anti-democratic feelings and his veneration for the violent and the arrogant individual who stands out against the majority. He gets more and more rash and impetuous in expressing that too. And as we know, as we have seen, that in fact does drive him into attitudes which I think can only be called fascist in the strictest and most alarming sense. And of course this is very attractive. The very old man refusing to grow old, refusing to mellow and mature to wisdom, and insisting on the contrary in being ever more intemperate, immoderate, ever more himself. One's imagination is stirred by this. You will remember that, in a sense, he was as good as his word, in that it wasn't merely, it never is with Yeats, as you and I hope have discovered, it's not merely a matter of technique in writing. He was as good as his word in his lifetime. Thus, for instance, in the early 30s, he underwent a specific surgical operation in order to ensure that he remained sexually alive and virile to the very end. And he made this known to the public at large. He becomes more explicitly erotic and obscene, or all but obscene, the older he gets. A sequence that you will look at called A Woman Young and Old. I don't know, the Crazy Jane song, yes, Woman Young and Old, which are furious, violent and shocking lyrics of sexual experience spoken through the mouth of an imagined persona called Crazy Jane are an example of this. And Yeats was very well aware of how shocking he was being. And he starts one extraordinary poem with, you think it horrible that lust and rage I, as you will gather from the tone of those recent comments and also from certain things that I said before, I incline to a slightly different view. Though he continues to write great and astonishing poems in every year of his life right up to the end, nonetheless, I think, for my own part, we have just been looking at the greatest Yeats, which I take to be the Yeats of the period of the First World War, and of the two collections that we just looked at, The Wild Swans at Kew and Michael Ruati's In the Delta. Even in those collections, you remember the double vision of Michael Robartes and my suggesting to you there that there was an element of sheer, what the right word for it would be, hamming it up, histrionics, tall talk, almost a shout. And this never takes over Yeats's writing, but it is from now on a continual possibility, which he increasingly does fall into, I think, as he grows through the last 20 years of his life. Also, another aspect of the matter, which I've also mentioned before, remember in relation to that little poem about a cat and the hare, and it turned out that the cat wasn't the cat, that was Mrs. Yeats, and the hare wasn't the hare, that was all gone. This too, I think, becomes increasingly characteristic of later Yeats. Less than ever, one might say, less than ever is he interested in the creatures, the beings of the external world for their own sake, or for what they can tell him about modes of being alien themselves. Always, or nearly always, increasingly at any rate, anything he sees, the things that crowd his poems are there only as symbols. They are there to be decoded. There is, for instance, a poem that you will read in this block of reading, an important poem, and in many ways a fine one, Cool Park and Valley Lee, 1931, which is, we've seen them before, it's another of those swan poems. As in The Wild Swans at Cool, as in Lee Down the Swan. So here, in Cool Park and Valley Lee, they are the same swans in the same place as in the poem The Wild Swans at Cool. It becomes even clearer in the later poem that they are not there, again, for their own sake, as having a mode of being different from the human and intriguing to the human. They are there as symbols. In the middle of this poem, he, having created the swans, he says, another symbol there. In other words, the swan, like the hare, like the cat, like the moon, is in fact never there, how can one say, the swan is never there for its swanliness. It is there for to be a projection of something inside the human observer. Symbol of the human. Well, again, this is not in itself, of course, a vice in poetry, but it does mean that Yeats is more clearly than ever before here a profoundly subjective poet, in the sense that ultimately, although his poetry seems to be full of specific sights and other creatures and other people than himself, in fact, he's interested solely in his own personality and his own ego. And this is an ego which moves around the world, as it were, devouring and grasping everything else that is out there. This is particularly true, I think, even with the poems, many of them very noble and moving poems, about his old friends. We've seen some of those already. We've seen this happened in memory of Major Robert Gregory. That includes the other poems come up of this sort, including a very fine one, a late one called The Municipal Gallery Revisited, where he tells the litany of the people he has known and valued. Often the same people. John M. Singh, Augusta Gregory, Lionel Johnson, and his own relatives. But gradually you come to realize, Finrod, you come to suspect such a valuable and distinct person as Singh, he's interested, through evoking Singh, to tell you something about a potentiality in himself, W.B. Yeats. From this point of view, it is, all right, the word subjective can become egotistical. Now, I'm not trying to tell you what to think about this body of poetry that we're now going to really wrap up this course by reading, trying to sketch two different attitudes that can be taken to it. And you will tend to like it more and more, or to get more and more suspicious of it, according, I dare say, as your own temperament, your own taste in poetry is for the subjective and egotistical, or for the, well, objective and classical. Yeats, it seems to me, came nearest to a classical style, if that's what one wants, a classical style and a classical attitude to life, in the poems that we've just been looking at, with the exception of those that depend particularly upon the system. Particularly, I had time only to squeeze it in at the end of yesterday's session, particularly that poem, well, two poems that related to that, Easter 1916, and the one that I was pushing in at the end of yesterday's session, A Prayer for My Daughter. This is, to me, a very real sense in which one can define this as classical in its achievement. And more classical than anything Yeats had done before or was to do again. One of the meanings of classical, for instance, in that connection would be precisely what I was, the last point that I was able to make yesterday, the fact that that poem uses no imagery, no symbol, no emblem, that is not wholly time-honored and traditional. And indeed, the 17th century presence that presides over that poem is perhaps the most classical of all the great English poets of the 17th century, that is to say, Ben Jonson. At any rate, we're going to see less and less of that. We're going to see more and more of, well, a sort of assertive, and I suppose, since we've thrown up the word of classical, we mean, once again, a more romantic sort of poetry. It's true to say that Yeats began as a late romantic. Again, in that poem, Coup d'Arcle Baladi, you will find him saying, "We were the last romantics." He's thinking of his friends of the 1890s then. And this is true. Then, under pressure, particularly of his of Irish history and his tormented engagement with it and attempts to disengage himself from it, as well as under pressure from friends and acquaintances like Ezra Pound, he achieves something more like a classical balance and impersonality. The Republic established, Yeats once again becomes, I think, egotistical and subjective, and in that sense romantic, though in a very different way. It is no longer the last remnant of 19th century genteel romanticism. It is a savage, distinctively 20th century sort of romanticism, such as you might associate with well, I'd like you to get the sense of these two attitudes which can be taken up for this body of work, and as you read through, try to decide which of them answers to your sense of this body of poetry, particularly. You'll gather the examination for this, the final examination for the course, is week Thursday in this room. Do it from 8 till 11, but I think we'll try to make it at 9 rather than 8. A two-hour examination. I'll explain what it is. I can give two poems, or perhaps three, of which you will be required to choose one to give an account of. These will be either poems that we have, well, they'll certainly be poems that we have referred to, but they may be poems that you have read, for instance, in the next 36 hours. Rather than poems that I have read and talked about. I did ask you to read, to look at one poem for today. One of the very finest poems of the early 1920s. This was, it's a long sequence of poems, in fact, Meditations in Time of Civil War, which is on page 102 and following. The Civil War. The Civil War is, I suppose by now you have it clearly enough in mind. Home rule was indeed granted after considerable hostilities between English soldiers and Irishmen. Home rule was granted, the treaty was signed. In 1920, and the Irish Free State came into being. However, the extremist nationalists in Ireland still thought that they had got only half or three quarters of what it was they were fighting for, and they disowned the relatively moderate nationalists, Griffiths and Collins, who had signed the treaty with the British and went into action, military action, to demand all or nothing. And these are the ancestors of the Irish Republican Army of today. And this was the Civil War, which lasted and was quite bloody and violent. Irishmen fighting Irishmen through the early years of the 1920s. You will remember the rather bitter way in which history brings in its revenges. The real cause of the dissension was the intransigence of Ulster. The Republicans, the out-and-out Republicans, pointed out quite rightly that when they had spoken of Home Rule, when Parnell had spoken of Home Rule, when O'Connell had spoken of Home Rule, it had always been taken for granted that this was the whole of the island, all the counties of Ireland. And indeed, when Gladstone, from his side, from the English side, had agreed to negotiate with Parnell, had given promise that the English Liberals would give Home Rule, he too had supposed that it meant the whole of Ireland. The new element which enters into the equation, and which neither the English on their side nor the Irish on their side can do anything about, is in fact the intransigence of the six counties of Ulster. Hence, the Republicans and were fighting the moderate Home Rulers in this civil war about something which neither of them could help. And that has, in fact, been the running sore in Ireland ever since, and is, of course, what is the unappeasable problem to this day. You will see how ironical history is. These intransigents of the northeast of Ulster are the descendants of the Scots and English puritanical Protestants who were brought in deliberately, you remember, through the plantation of Ulster at the beginning of the 17th century, when they were supposed to keep the island for the crown. The way things have worked out, they are now the people who gave the British, as well as the Irish, more trouble than anyone else. Well, this is the new equation. You will find very little about this in Yeats. Yeats had few friends and few contacts up there. He very seldom went into the north, into Ulster. And this too is characteristic. There is, among the Irish and the Anglo-Irish alike and their sympathisers, a sort of willful blindness to the fact that there are these 6 million Irishmen who do not want to be part of the Irish Republic.
recall the history that we started out by doing, this really goes back, you remember, to the point I made in the early 17th century, a simple twofold division between Protestants and Roman Catholic won't really meet the case. You have to have at least three, and I put them up on the board, both in English and in Irish 17th century history. The Episcopalian Protestants, like Yeats, the Anglo-Irish of the South, the Roman Catholic majority of the South, and then the Puritanical Protestants, the Presbyterians for the most part, of the Northeast, and your Episcopalian, like Yeats, or like Yeats' family through the centuries, feel themselves, if anything, more at odds with the Ulster, the fierce Ulster Calvinists, than they do with their Roman Catholic neighbors. Yeats writes a lot about Irish politics. He writes as if Ulster and its very peculiar and special history, a very peculiar and special character that has been formed by that history, does not exist. Anyway, that is the Civil War, in the midst of which he writes this sequence, which you have dated 1923. In fact, it appears to have been completed the year before that, 1922. Ancestral houses. Surely among a rich man's flowering lawns, amid the rustle of his planted hills, life overflows without ambitious pains, and rains down life until the basin spills, and mounts more dizzy high the more it rains, as though to choose whatever shape it wills, and never stoop to a mechanical or servile shape at others' beck and call. Mere dreams, mere dreams. Yet Homer had not sung, had he not found it certain beyond dreams, that out of life's own self-delight had sprung the abounding, glittering jet, though now it seems as if some marvellous, empty seashell flung out of the obscure dark of the rich streams and not a fountain were the symbol which shadows the inherited glory of the rich. Some violent, bitter man, some powerful man, called architect and artist, in that they, bitter and violent men, might rear in stone the sweetness that all longed for night and day, the gentleness none there had ever known. But when the masters buried mice can play, and maybe the great-grandson of that house, for all its bronze and marbles, but a mouse. Oh, what if gardens where the peacock strays with delicate feet upon old terraces, or else old Juno from an urn displays before the indifferent garden deities? Oh, what if levelled lawns and gravelled ways where slippered contemplation finds his ease and childhood a delight for every sense, but take our greatness with our violence? What if the glory of escutcheoned doors and buildings of the haughtier age designed, the pacing to and fro on polished floors, amid great chambers and long galleries lined with famous portraits of our ancestors, what if those things the greatest of mankind consider most to magnify or to bless, but take our greatness with our bitterness? First, I'll have you note that still now, in the 1920s, Yeats is in many important ways conservative, technically and stylistically. I've been at some pains to establish that he is very thoroughly part of the modern movement, and that he was aware of it, and that he thought of himself in relation to Ezra Pound, in relation to Picasso, to Brancusi. Perfectly well aware of it, greatly in sympathy with the cubist and other abstractions which characterized the modernist movement in the arts internationally in the first two decades of the present century. Nevertheless, unlike Pound, unlike Eliot, for instance, he always, virtually always, maintains traditional meters, as he does here. This is the iambic pentameter, handled with extraordinary assurance and skill, but it is the meter of Shakespeare, of Milton, of Wordsworth, of Tennyson, of how many more. Not only that, he also maintains the grammar of the sentence. These sentences here are difficult, they're saying difficult things, But at least, unlike, again, Pound and Eliot, you can go to work on them by grammatical analysis. Well, what is the subject of this sentence? What is the verb? What is the subject? You can analyze that way. In both of these ways, Yeats is then technically and stylistically conservative. And this is very, very important, I think, in his generation, in modern poetry. He is of those people who move near the center, near the middle of the modernist movement internationally. He is the man who holds most plainly and directly onto the inherited technical devices. And again, this is an example of how, in this man, the matter and the form actually go together. After all, he's always talking about how things are getting worse and all you can do is hold on to what the riches you have inherited for as long as possible. This is a basic contention of his politics, of his private morality, as he thinks of his own children, as in Prayer for My Daughter, and of his own writing. Here, he faces for the first time the fact that all these ancestral hazards, the aristocratic ways of life which those houses embody, houses like, of course, Cool Park, Lady Gregory's house, houses like the house to which he hopes at the end of A Prayer for My Daughter that his daughter's bridegroom will take her, and all the customs ceremonious. He now faces the fact that, okay, but good, these houses were first established by monstrous injustice, by expropriating the peasant landowners, the peasant smallholders. It is as if some sort of radical or